Welcome to this third lecture of the 1992 E.Y. Mullins Lectures. May I remind those who are participants in the National Biblical Preaching Conference that the 11 o'clock session immediately follows this session. We will meet back over in the Carver Building immediately following our lecture time today for the sermon workshops. I overheard someone saying that Gene Lowry invented narrative preaching. I think that would surprise Jesus. Dr. Lowry certainly did not invent narrative preaching, but he certainly has written about it. And I guess when his book in 1980 came out, The Homiletical Plot, he is attempting to teach us about it, how it works, why it works, the value of it, that we may learn more effectively how to use it. And this morning he's going to be lecturing on narrativity and narrative, and we wait with anticipation for his message to us.
Thank you very much, and good morning. I must say that I had to this experience with some degree of dis-ease. I need to explain what I mean by that. I mean, we started on Tuesday, and there was a choir behind me, and there was a text in front of me, and we were captured in the fullness of worship, and I felt that presence. And then yesterday, the piano was at my side. Well, the choir is not there. In fact, the organist has escaped. And the piano is far away. And here we are. It feels a kind of a little like an afterthought. On the other hand, it strikes me a moment of excitement, because I think what I'm wanting to do today is actually at the heart of the purpose of my entire trip here. But I am reminded, I thought of it as I walked over from the guest house this morning, of something that my dear friend Tex Sample said to me. He's a dear friend. He needs one, and I am one. I tell him it's an act of grace on my part. Some of you have read his writings, I know, from discussions since I've been here. Incredibly fine lecturer and marvelous preacher. That he would say to me, "Gene, you need to understand one thing very clearly." He said, "No church ever pays you to come preach. They pay you to come play the piano, and they put up with your preaching." Well, and today it's not even that you have to put up with my lecture. But what was wonderful and what gives me renewed hope is the selection and style of treatment of the hymn we just sang. And I can't move forward without asking you to retrieve the hymnal and turn back to page 124 for a quick look at what we're going to be about for this hour. You notice the obvious thing that was already pointed out, that the verse begins with the question and the refrain provides the answer. Question. Answer. Question, answer. Do you remember, those of you who were here yesterday, and I talked about what happens when we remove the third stanza of a four-stanza hymn? In this case, it was five, but look carefully at stanza four. Do you see it does not even begin with the same words as the others? All the others, who is he, who is he, who is he, and finally, who is he? We have the bridge. in stanza four. And the mood is altogether different. Always before, it's the one who has been the helper, the one who provides the answer for people in need. But in stanza four, it is he who is in Gethsemane. Did you notice how we sang the chorus or refrain in the fourth stanza? Altogether different. That was the bridge about which I spoke yesterday. And then once we completed the bridge, then we could return once again to the theme, which in this case was the question and the answer. A perfect illustration of what I was trying to communicate yesterday. Now, I thought I understood what I was supposed to do today. I helped select the title for it. I thought it was very clear, and it was until a week or so ago. That's when things begin to feel funny. The shape of narrative preaching. Now, I think I had in mind, and I think they had in mind, the question of what is the shape of a narrative sermon. That's the issue that we're going to address today. But then I got to thinking, are we talking about the shape of narrative preaching, or are we talking about what shape narrative preaching is in today? You hear the difference? And in fact, numerous conversations this week have centered on that second question. So I guess we'll just have to throw them together and double the angst for the morning. It was in 1971 that a little book got published in Enid, Oklahoma, of all places. Not Harper, not Abington, not Brodmann or Judson, but the Phillips University Press in Enid, Oklahoma. The very first lines of that volume start or begin, "In countless courts of opinion, the verdict on preaching has been reached, and the sentence passed. All this slim volume asks is a stay of execution until one more witness be heard." Heavy. And that was those were the beginning words of the book as "One Without Authority" by Fred Craddock, 1971, 20 and a bit more years ago. And in those 20 years, an enormous shift, a paradigm shift, has and is occurring in North American homiletics, what Richard Esslinger calls the Copernican Revolution in homiletics. And with that, a lot of confusion and not a little nonsense in those 20 years. Certainly the time was ripe for Fred Craddock to say what he said about the sentence, the verdict, the execution of the sermon. Some of you remember those days, I presume. I mean, it was a time when the mood was not for preaching. People were worn out with words. What with Marshall McLuhan and the television medium and all, I mean, the sermon seemed to be dead. In seminary, the popular courses were in either social action or pastoral care or media studies. We were in a mood of actions speak louder than words. The time was ripe. And also at that time, lurking around the edges were a whole lot of other disciplines. Now, they weren't particularly anxious to get into the fray of the homily. But those who were interested in preaching, many of them were interested in these new concerns. a biblical narrative criticism was emerging as a strong force in our world. Media analysis was hovering around with McLuhan and Ong and others, that leads into the whole issue of linguistics. There was interest in story theology. There was left brain, right brain beginning to emerge in terms of all these things were lurking close by. All that was necessary for us to reach into those territories was for somebody to give permission. Because these things were worth more than just a small paragraph in a long text on preaching. They were vital, and in some cases were radical, but nobody had given their permission. Well, not just anybody could give permission. It had to be a person understood and respected discipline, like New Testament. It had to be someone with a keen analytical and analogical mind who could probe the nuances of meaning. It had to be a person whose way with words, a love for the English language and a way with words, where once he would say something some way, you could never think of it again another way. You had to have someone with a sense of wisdom, not just learning, but wisdom and wit. And the one was Fred Craddock. And so he opened the door. Now, he called it inductive preaching. But many of the people who walked through that door wore name tags that said narrative preaching rather than his inductive preaching. In fact, Fred has not been altogether happy with all the people who walked through the door. But he opened it just the same, and a lot of folks have walked through. And note, too, that these people who walk through come with different voices. So if you want to be critical of narrative preaching, it's very simple. Or is it story preaching? Or is it episodal preaching? Or is it first-person preaching? Or, well, what would you call it? Well, you want to attack the movement in general? It's very simple. Here's how you do it. You pick the person, you pick the voice that you least like, and you smash them, and presume that when they get smashed, all the other voices are equally smashed. And that's been going on now for some 20 years. Never mind, you don't have to be particular. I mean, just lump everything together, narrative preaching, story preaching, inductive. Just lump it all together and call it entertainment. But it's deeper than that, because in fact there's remarkable confusion inside among the voices, those of us who are advocates. I remember that moment in history very well, because when that book came out, it was only 3 years after I had taken this position, leaving religious work in the pastorate to teach preaching in a seminary. And I remember well a colleague of mine, a new colleague at that point, who welcomed me to the faculty one day. He said, "Well, Gene, welcome to the faculty of St. Paul School of Theology." He said, "I understand that you're going to be teaching blacksmithing." Did you hear what he was saying? I didn't feel exactly welcomed by the remark. But I decided to teach anyway, and the first thing I had to do in every class I taught was try to defend to the students why preaching was a required course at St. Paul. That was the kind of day we were in, and enormous confusion since that time. Now, it's time for clarity. Time for clarity. And by the way, a recent journal article by John McClure from across the street in a Journal for Preachers has been very helpful. Maybe some of you have seen it. He said, when you talk about narrative preaching, you got to figure out what direction you're going. He said, are you talking, on the one hand, narrative hermeneutics, in other words, the issue of biblical criticism? Is that where you're headed? Or he says, are you talking about narrative semantics? by which he means people like me. Now, I don't care for the use of semantics in that context, but when it once explained, it's clear he's talking about the shape of the sermon. He said, "Are you wanting to talk about narrative enculturation, the issue of imagination and metaphor?" Or he says, "Are you interested in narrative worldview," by which he means faith story. He said, "You got to figure out what direction, what room you're entering, or you won't know how to do business in terms of narrative preaching." There's another person who's tried to clarify some issues, Lucy Rose, who teaches at Columbia Seminary and whose work is not yet out, but wonderful and important work that we will hear from soon. She says, "Are we talking about the purpose of preaching? Are we talking about the biblical base, in other words, biblical criticism? Are we talking about the language of preaching or the shape of sermonic material?" And she includes me in that fourth one, meaning the dealing with the shape of material. And still, with that clarity that John McClure or Lucy Rose give us, we still don't even know what narrative preaching really is. Some say this paradigm shift, you know, is a fundamental shift, including such ingredients, appears to be a shift from deductive to inductive, from rhetoric to poetics, from space to time, from literality to orality, from prose to poetry, from hot to cool, from creed to hymn, from science to art, from left brain to right brain, from proposition to parable, from direct to indirect, from construction to development, from discursive to aesthetic, from theme to event, from description to image, from point to event, from authoritarian to democratic, from truth to meaning, from account to experience. Now, you do have that, don't you? All of the above appear to be included as variables in this shift, this paradigm shift in preaching, but notice I said appears, because it's just not as easy as all that. So why don't we try as best we can? Why don't we try as best we can to at least define some terms that might be helpful as a start? For example, is story preaching the same thing as narrative preaching? No. Now remember, you're about to get my view, not somebody else's, but mine. No, I say, a story always has to do with the content of a space and time moment or moments. Once upon a time, there was a man who had two sons. In the year King Uzziah died, or whatever it has the particulars of event that happen in space and time. And when you have a story, you always have characters in the story, and they always butt up against the realities or parameters of context or setting, and there is always action then that takes place, and there's always tone. That seems like a pale word. What it means is the veto power of the narrator. I mean, you know, what you choose to say or don't say, or how you say what you say, it has everything. All of those ingredients or elements of narrative are always in a story. But notice there's something underneath all of those four, and that's a principle. And it's a principle of a shape. And that shape, in fact, you can take the characters out, you can take the context or setting out, you can take the tone out, you can take everything out, and you still got the principle. That's narrative preaching. That is to say, let's just imagine. Now, I'm going to ask a rhetorical question in the sense that I know the answer I'm looking for, so I'm just going to give it rather than ask it. It's a little more honest, perhaps. For example, supposing there is this guy, and we say, you know, he's really into medicines. Did you hear the plural on that? He's really into medicines. What is your image of the person without thinking too deeply? Well, the answer I'm looking for is hypochondriac. And can't you see him? His pockets are bulging with pill bottles. I mean, he's just got too many of them and taking them too long. He's really into medicines. He's into particular substances, don't you see? It's the word substance I'm looking for. Now, supposing I say of another person, she's really into medicine. Did you hear it? She's really into medicine. What's your image? Well, someone in medicine, a doctor, no doubt, or somebody related to the healing arts. Now, what's the connection between his medicines and her medicine? Do you hear the difference? His have to do with substances, and they're a subset of her process of medicine. But medicines are only one piece of her process. Sometimes she doesn't prescribe any medicines, you know. Let us suppose that this guy who's really into medicines winds up being her patient. She says, bring all your medicines with you, so he brings in a briefcase full, dumps them out on the table, and she can't believe what she sees. She says, these will kill you if you take them all. She says, we got to throw these out, and she sweeps them off into the wastebasket, and she says, reaching for a pad, scribbling as she was taught to do in med school, she says, now this is the medicine you take. I don't want you to take anything else. I don't mean aspirin or Tylenol or Advil, nothing, but this is your... Now you see, now we've got him down to one medicine. Still, we ask, what is the connection between his medicine and her medicine? It's a world of difference. He's got a substance. She's got a process that moves from illness to health, from possible death to life. Well, that's what we're about, isn't it? Help me with some of the words we might use when we preach. We're trying to move people from, help me, from darkness to light, or from death to life, or to from addiction to freedom, or from, I didn't hear it, despair to, you see, I mean, that's the business of preaching. That's the business of the corporate body of Christ, the church. And therefore, you can have that medicine in terms of the healing art of the gospel. And it may or may not have a story as it's proclaimed on Sunday morning. For me, that's the difference between story and narrative, although it doesn't say everything, and so we're going to have to wait a bit. Now, what about inductive preaching? Is inductive preaching the same thing as narrative preaching? Well, yes, it is. Well, no, it isn't. Well, I mean, it's sort of the same, but it's sort of not. For example, if I were to ask the question, what, in terms of my model of preaching, what would you use, what ingredient, or what would you do to complicate a plot? Well, probably inductive reasoning, but not always. Sometimes simple juxtaposition of conflictual material will do it quite nicely, thank you. And if you were to ask about inductive preaching, what is the consequence of the inductive process? Well, someone might say, well, it'll certainly complicate the plot. But not always. Sometimes the work of induction will bring from particular to general, at one spot, and then you begin again with another one, and another, and in the process, actually, there's a lessening of tension and an increase of clarity. Sometimes. In fact, if you, those of you who know the loop as I draw it, there's a sense in which the first two-thirds of it is inductive with Fred. As soon as you get to the bottom of the heap that conventional wisdom will get you, once you're at the bottom of that point and head up again, then it's deductive. So my loop starts with what I call liberal induction and concludes with Barthian deduction. So they're not exactly the same. Well, what do you do with episodal preaching? Is that narrative preaching? Well, yes, it is. Well, sort of. Is it inductive? Yeah, well, it's sort of. Well, because you see what episodal preaching does is you have these vignettes. Sometimes I know I have a friend of mine who's a preacher who will tell this story at the beginning of a sermon, a long story, and when you get through, it's a wonderful story, but you don't know what to do with it. But you trust the preacher because the preacher told it so well. And you say, well, let's stick around. And then in the middle, there's all this discursive material, and it leads, well, where does it lead? Well, you're not sure. You think it's connected to the first story, but you're not sure how. And finally, he will tell a third ingredient, or probably a story. And at the point of the punchline of the third story, it's like he sprays glue over all the sermon that had already happened. In other words, not until you get the final point of the final story do you understand the glue that holds everything together. That's what I call episodal preaching. It involves elements of inductive and elements of narrative. And then, what do you do with Buttrick? Well, I'm going to be generous. He wouldn't call it generous. He would call it loose. But I'm going to draw him in to the fold of narrative preaching. Now, he's coming kicking and screaming. But I'm going to drag him in through the door, because he talks about moves. He talks about sequence of plotted moves as the sermon. And if you want, now, when he talks about narrative preaching, it's generally in the context of the mode of immediacy, as he calls it, when he talks about narrative sermons. But nonetheless, he's constantly talking about moves. Now, by the way, I want to redefine his terms. He doesn't want me to do this either, but I say, if you want to understand Buttrick's homiletic, first of all, you change the word move. He doesn't have five or six moves. He has five or six stops. The moves are implicit in between the stops. Do you hear that? In fact, if you want to compare his view of preaching and my view of preaching, just imagine a sermon as a string of pearls. David Buttrick is interested in the pearls. I'm interested in the string. But we're not antithetical, and I will draw him in. Well, and what about first-person sermons? Well, they basically work inductively, although they move toward acting, toward drama, rather than toward preaching, technically defined. But it also has narrative shape. It moves generally story-like through with the character moving through events. And then there's black preaching, which is really remarkable because, in one sense, traditional black preaching in North America looks more like traditional preaching than most white preaching today does. That is, as Mitchell would say, you start with exegesis and you move to exposition and you move to application and you move to illustration. But there's a significant addition that changes the character of the whole. And that is, at the end, is celebration. And that changes the expectancy. You see, you can go through deductive preaching if you have an expectation of something that's going to happen. And in African-American experience, you always know that sermon is not going to be through until we have ourselves a celebration. And that's why the congregation can risk to say to the preacher, take your time. Because they know that come at the end will be a celebration that they've been anticipating through all the minutes of the sermon. But if pale people try to do that without celebration, it is called deadly. It can happen in that context because of the narrative expectation. Well, now I said that narrative preaching appears to be a paradigm shift of several ingredients. Let's look at some and see that it isn't just a dichotomy of either or. I said, for example, it seems to be a shift from deductive to inductive. But you notice when you say that, you have to be very careful because you're not talking in a pure way. You who are deductive preachers use illustrations. And the moment you say, the other day I was walking downtown, and the moment you do that, you're in inductive. You're in an inductive movement. Because that story is going to have finally a point, a conclusion. And so all the way through a typical deductive sermon, you're going to have fairly large moments of induction. Or let's turn it around. You're an inductive preacher. Does that mean you don't ever do anything deductive in the sermon? No. As a matter of fact, You may, in the inductive process, stop to say something about the results. Did you hear the word? The results, the conclusions of some social scientist's work. And you announce it deductively. Maybe it's the work of a fine biblical scholar on the parables. And you announce it deductively in the framework and to the purpose of a larger inductive process. So when you talk deductive and inductive, it is not pure. It is not, inductive preaching is not climbing, is not simply climbing an unknown mountain in the fog without any known reference points. Because if it is, let me tell you, it is a bad inductive sermon. You just can't do things either or. Likewise, it's true in terms of authoritarian and democratic. Now, I really did enjoy it when Fred said in that first volume, he said, in terms of deductive preaching, he said, if the listeners are on the team, it is as javelin catcher. Isn't that nice? As javelin catcher. Well, it does have a point, doesn't it? But it's not quite that clear. The question is, where does the preacher stand? You've got God here, preacher here, congregation here. With whom and where does the preacher stand? In the more traditional type preaching, the preacher tends, notice the word, tends to lean towards standing with God as the latest teller. In the newer or narrative-shaped sermon, it's more likely that the preacher stands with the congregation as the first listener to God. But then again, it depends on who the preacher is. I've known deductive preachers who, in fact, would stand the other place, and inductive preachers who would stand the other place. This is a tendency, not an either-or. Or again, the difference between a creed and a hymn. Now, in one sense, every creed has some sort of narrative structure to it. I mean, you may start with creation and move to eschatology. Most of the creeds do that. Some of the creeds work through the Trinity, and I want to tell you, when they move through the Trinity, they don't start with the Holy Spirit. They start with the first person of the Trinity. So there is already a narrative flow to a creed. On the other hand, is it not true that technically each ingredient has a kind of separable integrity? One could recite the Nicene Creed every other line and then go back and pick the ones you missed and still actually have some semblance of sense. But you can't do that with a hymn. Every note relies on the immediately previous note and on the sequence that have been happening of the notes leading to this one. So hymn has more sense of necessary connection. But have you ever noticed, those of you who are traditional preachers with outlines, they're always Roman numeraled, right? 1, 2, and 3. Now, technically, if you follow the rules of outlining that's drawn from Greek rhetorical principles, if you do that, you'll notice something about 1, 2, and 3, and that is that they're not only separable, distinct, but they're also interchangeable. Three qualities of discipleship. Well, just toss them up and see which hits the ground first. See? Because each one is parallel with the other one, and each is equally subservient to the main thesis, right? Aren't those the rules we learned in Speech 101? But have you noticed, you who are more traditional in your preaching, have you noticed how many times you could not take Roman numeral 1 point and make it point 3? Wouldn't work. You can't take 3 and make it 2 and shove 2 to 1 because the thing becomes nonsense. Well, guess what's happening? There is a narrative principle lurking around somewhere. It's even those who are traditional preachers actually have implicitly often a sense of narrativity in the outline of the traditional sermon. Or in terms of literality and orality, Fred Craddock noted the time when the preacher, perhaps sensing that the sermon isn't going well, he said, the preacher will lay the notes aside and just begin to talk to the people. And what I think happens, have you ever done that? where you know something's not happening, and you just start. Two things happen when you just start talking to people, likely. One is you move from deduction to induction, because it's the natural way to talk. People seldom talk deductively, except in formal address or in writing term papers, dissertations. So when you lay the notes aside and begin just to talk to the people, very likely you move to induction. And you turn to grammar, you turn to syntax for the ear, where the notes were written for the eye. Those two things happen. But again, it's not either or. I suppose the biggest issue in terms of the paradigm shift for me is from construction to development. You know, you surely would never hear a composer talk about constructing an overture. Can you imagine constructing a piece of music? No, you shape it. You don't construct it. I mean, it's the difference between space and time. You don't even use the word organize, as though you've got separable parts that you're going to try to make feel like an organic whole. Remember H. Grady Davis? H. Grady Davis talked about a sermon is like a tree. It has its own natural growth. It's organic. You don't make trees. You prune them so they grow the direction you hope them to grow. Now, that's the difference between construction. I mean, construction is some event, that some manufacturing process that happens in space. You can see the building go up now. But development has to do with time in terms of shaping the sequence of events. What I say to my students is, you are not given ideas to organize. You are given 20 minutes to shape. The question, you see, really is, are we to engage ideas with people on hand, or are we to engage people with ideas in hand? You hear the difference? That's the difference, it seems to me, between construction and development. Likewise, with Buttrick's notion of the sequence of plotted moves. And you remember the times he says you don't always follow the sequence of the scripture passage. Sometimes, because what you want to have happen for the people is what the passage did, performative, then you may want to start in the middle of the passage and then pick up the beginning later. And it's shaped on the basis of your plot. That is development. But it's not either or. I suppose the worst one and most misunderstood one is the issue of discursive to aesthetic. How many times I've heard people say and seen people writing who say, well, you know, story's all right, but there are certain things that story can't do. It can't engage in an argument. Sometimes, you know, and I say, oh, no, wait a minute. Back behind here, we've got ourselves a dichotomy. We've got a dichotomy between thinking and feeling. I thought we'd buried that one a long time ago. But in fact, if you read Killinger's book put out in 85, he says one of the chief purposes for an illustration is to wrest the people from thought. Do you hear that? To wrest people from thought? He says, well, you know, listening to hard reasoning is difficult, and particularly when the argument is tightly argued. Do you hear tightly argued? He said, people got to have a release. And so he said, you rest them from thought. Now, what's he saying? He's saying that a story cannot carry the burden, the freight of thought. Do you hear that? That's an unwise dichotomy, it seems to me. In fact, often it's story that is the most convincing way to make a discursive point, finally. Otherwise, somebody should have told Jesus. When the Lord said, who is my neighbor? Let me give you 3 points, said Jesus. No, he didn't. He said, well, there was this guy who was walking down the road, and you said, now, wait a minute, how do I fend off this story? Well, you wait to the punchline, and then it's too late. I mean, you've been had, you see? Sometimes conviction can happen more effectively and efficiently through aesthetic means. What a wonderful writing is Gabriel Rico. How many of you know the work Writing the Natural Way? Well, I recommend it. R-I-C-O, Writing the Natural Way. And she quotes, and I've forgotten the name, the person who wrote the Centered Skier. But what Rico said is so marvelous. She says, metaphor is a bilinguist that connects the two hemispheres. Isn't that wonderful? It operates in between the left brain discursive thought and the right brain aesthetic gestaltive thought. And it operates, have you ever noticed when somebody uses a powerful metaphor and you receive it, do you notice what happens to you when a metaphor works? I mean, the first thing that happens is that the right brain gets it. You're shocked. You either start to cry or you laugh or you lose your breath for 3 seconds. I mean, the metaphor hits the right brain in a gestaltive way, and then you notice that that's not all that happens. All of a sudden, the left brain starts scrambling to make discursive sense of the metaphor. The problem is that the left brain can't get it nicely in shape. It always spills out over the edges because there's not a single referent to a metaphor. It's a tensive symbol, not a steno symbol. But there are those who like to think that no, discursive thought is thinking. Aesthetic thought is feeling. I want to say, no, they're both epistemological categories. Do you remember Fred Buechner in Telling the Truth when he had Pilate? You remember Pilate as he portrayed him? He's riding in a limo down to his office. He's riding in the back seat of this limo. He looks out on the street, and Fred Buechner says so quickly, he said, through tinted glass. I mean, it says it all. How many paragraphs of prose would you have to write to say discursively exactly what he meant? It's talking about economy and power. Pilate looked through tinted windows. I mean, it comes in a flash. And another has to do with proposition and parable. You know, Walter Brueggemann's great work when he talks about the prophetic imagination calls us to vision. And when he does that, he's not saying the vision's all there is. In fact, I like the writing of Roth on story and reality. He said there are four levels of knowing. He said first is the vision, then there's the aesthetic embodiment, and then there's the ethical ramifications, and finally there's the philosophical rationalization. See, systematic theology occurs at level 4, and it's indispensable. Traditional sermons also tended to operate at that level, but says Roth, what's really real is the vision. I mean, the good Jew looks through the paradigm of the Exodus. Any good Jew, what does the world look like? Well, it's through the Exodus, and for the Christian, it's through the Incarnation. You don't look so much at it as you look through it. It's the vision by which you perceive the world. That's pretty aesthetic. And that's that has to do with vision. But both are important. If you just have wild visions and don't have any discursive rationality, you're going to drop off the edge of some cliff, I promise. It's just inevitable. You've got to have a dialogue going up and down from vision to aesthetic embodiment to ethical ramification to philosophical rationalization and back up, back in. You know, that's why, for example, I don't really know what to do with the doctrines of the atonement. It's more helpful to me if I think of metaphors of the atonement. Because, you know, there are some days that only a substitutionary theory of the atonement will do for my life. But I better not pour it into concrete. There are some days when only Abelard's understanding, and Abelard, I think, is so misunderstood. He's always talked about by those who don't like him, you know. In terms of moral influence, he's not talking just moral influence. He's talking about the luringness of God's incredible love that lures us into wholeness. Well, there are some days that is what the atonement is. And some days I am so utterly caught by those powers that will not let me go. I have to be ransomed. Well, which it just depends on which day of the week I happen to be. But you see, if you drop the discursive rationality into concrete, you make it an idol. And you can't get loose.
But when you think of it metaphorically, all of a sudden you can begin to see the nuances of the interplay of the various, quote, theories of the atonement. Most of all, I suppose, from Fred Craddock's work comes the notion that we move from theme to event. He says, experience, the experience of the listener is the alpha and the omega of preaching. He said, the goal is not to get something said, but to get something heard. Experience. The role of traditional preaching tends to focus on conviction. The issue of narrative preaching has to do with evocation. I love the way Harry Emerson Fosdick put it, although I'm not as much an optimist as Harry Emerson Fosdick. He's more liberal than I. But you remember what Fosdick said? He said, the goal of a sermon on forgiveness is not to explain to people so they will understand the nature, quality, and ramifications of forgiveness. The role of a sermon on forgiveness is to cause to be a forgiving spirit in the congregation at that hour. Do you hear it? Evocation. Now, I say, I don't think the preacher causes it. I, in a sense, disagree with Fosdick there, just as I would disagree with Buttrick about his optimism about shaping consciousness. I don't think I'm in the business of doing things to people. My goal is to maximize the capacity to evoke. As Eliseo Viva says, we're midwives. We're midwives who bring into birth that which is larger and bigger than we. But it's evocation. It isn't just, you see, the danger of the traditional sermon is for it to turn into a mere report. The danger of narrative sermon is to fade off into indecisiveness. I mean, the whole point, you see, of the sermon is to get the ball in their court. But if the ball evaporates before you get through with the narrative sermon, there's nothing to take home. I do not believe in open-ended sermons. I just don't want to get through. I mean, I just don't want the people to get through before I get through, that's all. In fact, it can really be pulled down to the issue of rhetoric and poetics. And here's what I came to say this week. I don't think the paradigm shift in preaching is a move from an either-or, mutually exclusive, from the principles of rhetoric to the principles of poetics. What I think we have here is a figure-ground shift. We have been taught for years to use a rhetorical envelope and insert poetic type ingredients. Isn't that what we've been taught? You use an illustration here, you use a poem there, you have a rhetorical shape of the sermon and you insert poetics inside that envelope. Now imagine what would happen to your mind and your preaching if you simply shifted the figure and ground and say, what preaching is to be shaped by a narrative envelope and the rhetorical principles go inside that envelope. Do you hear the difference? It's not either or. It's both and. The question is, which is the basket and which are the eggs. Now, in the rhetorical envelope, you not only had poetically inspired material, you also had discursive reasoning. Likewise, in the narrative envelope, you don't just have discursive thought, you also have metaphor, image, story, etc. But fundamentally, what I think has happened in 20 years, and the best way we can think of narrative preaching so that we can have some clarity in our mind is to imagine that instead of the rhetorical envelopes with poetics inside, we've got a narrative envelope with rhetoric inside. Let me say it with the more quickly than that. What is narrative preaching? This is kind of a reductionism, but it'll have to do. Narrative sermon has to do with a sermon which moves from an itch to a scratch. Can you believe I traveled all this way to say that? A narrative sermon is a sermon that moves from an itch to a scratch. With the help of a musical scale, I think I can demonstrate it even better. Let's just take, I will hum a scale and we'll gesture where a sermon is in the scale. There's where the sermon exists. But the moment you say, it's over. I mean, the preacher may continue to talk, but the sermon is over.